Hello, and welcome to the Sprocket Podcast. My name is Brock Dittus.
And I'm Aaron Flores. We're broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
And lest you thought I forgot, this is the place where we are simplifying the good life. We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Covering day-to-day life, food, alcohol, bicycles, and alternative transportation, arts and culture, communication, and the internet, and today, Car-Free Village.
That's right. Yeah, we've got an interview with Tracy Gayton from the Piscataquis Village Project. We talked with him, well, I talked with him some time back, and he's a fascinating fellow, a lot of great stuff to say about city design and whatnot, and I had ice in my beard. I had an icicle beard for the very first time.
Oh, yeah.
I think maybe in my life.
It was frost all day on the ground.
Yeah. It was Friday morning when I went in.
Ah.
Not the day when it was actually icy on the ground. And it should be noted that Aaron is drinking coffee out of a Pyrex mixing
glass.
Wide mouth. We're going to show, we'll show you a picture of that on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com.
Yeah.
Be the first thing you see when you get there. Yeah, we had some ice on the ground, and that's not unusual for other parts of the country, but for Portland, it's a shit storm. No one knows what to do with it. And
yeah.
The reason is because we have actually some fairly unique weather phenomenon here, I think. Like, we had freezing fog about a week ago.
Yeah, well, it was really foggy this morning, even.
Yeah, yeah, it hangs around.
Cold. Yeah.
And stagnant air, if I'm not mistaken, either yesterday or the day before.
Which is also not characteristic of Portland winter.
Right, yeah. I had on my morning commute, I believe it was, we're recording this on a Saturday, it would have been 8 days prior to now, I was
that
going
would have
been
in. Last Friday?
Yes.
All right.
Not yesterday, but a week before Friday. Yes. Well done. And I had that funny feeling where your tires start to slip out from underneath you.
Oh, yeah.
I was actually riding up Martin Luther King Boulevard. It's one of the, probably the highest traffic roads in the city.
Yeah.
One of them. I guess there's a lot of roads in the city. It gets a lot of traffic, but early in the morning when I'm doing my commute, there's not nearly as much there. And the way things worked out, I was kind of riding uphill, and I felt the telltale slippage of my back wheel and thought, oh my, I should probably get off the main roads.
Yeah.
So I did, and it wasn't any better anywhere else. I ended up going in like
but
at
less
5
risk
miles an
of
hour.
Like getting run over, maybe.
Right, right, yeah. By a speeding car that cannot stop itself.
Right, right.
So... yeah, it was actually, it was probably pernicious for the reason that we had no indication in my neighborhood that there was anything on the ground. Like, down here in outer southeast Portland, it was cold, but there was no precipitation. No. It wasn't like frozen
yeah, it
over.
Didn't it didn't start snowing until like 7:30-ish?
Right.
8-ish?
Yeah.
And yeah, you're right, because I commuted. It wasn't that Friday. It was Thursday, maybe.
Okay.
I commuted, and it, like, started coming down on me. But it wasn't until, like, I crossed that line at Powell.
Yeah. Yeah, you just have to get to different places, and then all of a sudden the weather changes. So you're safe.
We're both safe.
I'm safe.
We're
yeah.
here. We're alive.
I was following the Bike Portland comment thread on icy weather.
Yeah.
And it's funny. If you comment and then choose to receive additional comments by email, you get a ton of email.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's great. But it was very interesting because it's people talking about how they do things. There was one guy, I can't remember what his name was, but he talked about how he rides over Council Crest in the snow and ice. And he has...
for fun?
I think for his commute, oh. But he likes it as well. It's also enjoyable. He derives
wow.
pleasure from
that's
the activity.
A, that's a special kind of masochism that I yeah. have never experienced before.
Yeah. I think he had studded tires. Okay. And he probably also had wider tires to help absorb some of that stuff. And he said, you know, just ride in straight lines and go slowly. And yeah, it helps you out. So there was that. The months-long soaking of socks was something that I wrote down to talk about, to mention today, because have you ever lost a pair of socks and found that they were sitting in stagnant water for 6 months?
No, but I think I know where you're going with this.
The socks I'm wearing right now,
yeah,
they're smart wool socks, and I lost them. I don't think I've said this on the show before, have I?
No, you have
okay,
not.
All right.
You've told this story to maybe myself and a few friends.
Okay. So I was going on a rafting trip with some folks, and it was that, you know, we go by bus and go up the Clackamas River and ride down the whole river and come back on bus. and you can do the whole thing without a car.
Right. This was, did Brandon mention this on one of the episodes?
Oh, we've talked about rafting a lot.
Okay.
About the socks specifically?
No. I mean, this particular adventure.
This particular one, I don't know if we mentioned or not. We might have. But it's great. It's good fun. But what happens is we come home usually, and we put the boat away. And then, we just kind of forget about the boat for a year until it's time to take the boat out again. And then you have to patch it up and clean it off and get all the moss off of it and everything. We could probably take better care of it. We're actually storing it inside now because we have more garage space than we used to.
So probably no moss.
No moss. Year. Less moss, at least. that's not Jonathan Moss. We're okay with him. We'll take as much moss as we can get. But lichens
that'll
that grow.
That'll come later.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll
lichens and algae. Those things are no fun.
Yeah.
But it was when we were moving from house to house. I moved one house back from the house I used to live in.
Right.
Still renting. Haven't really moved up in the world, except that we have a bigger house and it's slightly nicer.
And it's much nicer.
Yeah. So I was dumping some of the stagnant water out of the boat tub. They're like Rubbermaid tubs that we keep the boat in. And it had acquired some water from rainfall and that sort of thing. And I discovered at the bottom a pair of smart wool socks that I had been missing for 6 months.
Now, as you see these socks, did you have like one of those moments of like, oh, I've been looking for those?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, this is a specific pair that I really enjoyed. They're like, you know, ankle cut, so they don't come up too high. They don't get in your way when you're trying to keep your legs cool in the summertime. And yet they still provide cushioning and moisture transfer from the soles of your feet.
Do they have that like sort of special elastic on the, on the arch of your foot?
They used to.
Oh.
Check these out. So half of the wool material that like makes them soft and cushy is now gone. But, I guess that's what happens when you let socks soak in stagnant water for 6 months. So you're taking a picture now?
I am.
Prove it to the people, sir.
That's right. The people need to know.
Right. And the funny thing is, like, you know, usually when you wear out socks, I guess these are kind of on the usual wear areas, but it's like half of the fibers were just disintegrated. They're still fine for wearing around the house and whatnot. And I think I wore them to work yesterday and they're all right. I love smart wool.
So, like, okay, and maybe we'll post this picture on the on the site, too. Because I can see your feet through there.
Yes. Well, someday soon they're going to be like ladies' hose. But instead of normal socks where, you know, they fall apart.
Right.
These...
They're still staying together. And, like...
They're structurally intact.
Are your feet warm?
Mostly.
Because mine are freezing. I have, like, complete socks here.
Are those cotton socks?
They are.
Oh, that's why.
That's my problem.
Cotton kills, man. I mean,
it's almost as bad as polyester.
I don't want to make it. Yeah. Ooh. Zing. Well done.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I'm poor. I can't afford smart wool.
Yeah, man. No, it was like 2 years ago when we started this show, I really wanted some smart wool and I had never had some because it's expensive.
I want to say like it's also an investment and I do have some wool socks that I'm like, yeah, these are my winter socks.
True enough. Well, hey, we're drinking some stuff.
We're drinking things.
This is the sober show, as you say.
Yeah.
You're drinking coffee out of a Pyrex mixing glass.
Yeah, I don't know if this counts as the sober show. This is almost, if I were a drinker, this sounds
we didn't say
to
it
me
was
anyways.
Sane.
Right. As this is like something I would imagine I would drink out of like the night after, you know, I just... wandering around the, you know, or the day after, I should say, you know, after a night of drinking.
Sure.
Wandering around the kitchen.
Like, man, I need some coffee.
I need something, and I am barely conscious enough to, like, find an actual mug. Come across this, you know, and anyways.
Well, it should be noted that my wife Adele makes her coffee that way every day.
That's true. But she also pours it in.
She does strain it through a sieve.
Yeah.
I'm drinking Irish breakfast tea.
Right on.
Because, well, what? Thin times.
Hey, you got to eat and I got to eat.
Yeah. I've overspent my personal spending budget by $15 so far this month, and it's only bound to get more.
It amazes me how exact you are with your budget.
I
know I'm over my budget.
Maybe it's better just
to be
zen
with
that.
I don't know by how much.
See, I have this false hope that I can make up the deficit, you know, by spending less later. And I find I'm so impulsive especially like, you know, I don't know, after, you know, a long week of work and I'm like, hey, it's the weekend. I want to go get a tasty malt beverage from the corner store.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. Those things add up over time.
That's true.
So.
Yes.
Yeah. Moderation. It's temperation.
Even a $4 burrito.
Right.
The local burrito cart, which is calling my name, has been calling my name all week.
Yeah.
I won't do it. I won't do it.
Well, here's to, you know, to fuller times down the road in which you can buy a burrito.
Damn right.
Hey, do you want a burrito?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
good,
I do.
Good, good.
I think I've said that almost verbatim.
Yeah, well, if you don't want one and you were still forced to buy one, that would be a sad story.
Right.
You just got a brand new device.
This is why times are thin for me.
In the name of simplification.
That's right. This is an investment, much like Smart Wool.
Yeah.
I mentioned last episode, got a iPod 5, iPod Touch Generation 5. And this is, listeners, this is to get out of the cell phone game.
Yeah, so this is actually in the name of simplification.
Right, right. Like simplify, whatever, Aaron. No, this is to get rid of my cell phone, which come January 28th, no more.
All right, that's when you're getting rid of it altogether.
That's the last day of the billing cycle.
Yeah. And you've been kind of setting up your system. As mine is, so Google Voice catches your calls?
Yes. So Google Voice catches my calls. I set up a Google Voice number, and now within the 503 area code. Even.
Yeah.
And the program Talkatone handles all of my actual calling in and out. There's still some wrinkles to iron out.
Some kinks to be figured out.
Yeah. And eventually, I think what I'm going to end up doing is getting myself a hotspot of some kind. Like really
a wireless mobile hotspot?
Yeah, yeah, just a really cheap hotspot.
You can get your data on the fly that way.
Right. And that's if I were in a spot where I couldn't find Wi-Fi.
Right.
For example, I was riding the Max to meet my special lady friend last night.
Your special lady friend, you said?
Yes. Yes. We were going to meet at the Lloyd Center.
Oh, yeah?
And
what
we
were you
did
gonna do there?
Well, watch a movie.
Good times.
Plans were kind of to meet there at the Lloyd Center Max station and then walk on to the theater.
Yeah.
And that's what ended up happening. But as I was going, I was thinking, you know, if plans were to change as we are used to doing in a cell phone kind of mentality, you can easily change them like on the fly.
Right.
You know, and be
right.
Like, oh, actually, let's go to the theater downtown. And
I decided I don't want to pay $16 plus popcorn.
But we didn't pay any dollars.
Oh, there we
go. These were a present from her parents.
Oh, nice, nice.
So, yeah.
Well, that was nice of them.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Stewart.
Oh.
Anyhow, that's what I was thinking was, oh man, if plans were to change, then she would have no way to get a hold of me, or like say I fell asleep and ended up in Beaverton or something, you know, I would have, you know.
Ending up in Beaverton, a face, a fate worse than death.
No!
Across county lines.
Here?
And into suburbia.
But yeah. But in the meantime, also, that's a cell phone mentality. That's a cellular world mentality.
Yeah. Buy and
growing
sell
up,
stocks.
Yeah, growing up, like, even a answering machine, you know, I'm old. Even an answering machine wasn't heard of when I was growing up. And we survived.
You did okay.
The species perpetuated itself regardless.
Against all odds, nature finds a way.
Right. So, you know, I think I can manage.
Yeah. Well, I have the utmost faith in you. I think, just over the past couple of years, you've taken on several new practices. You know, like you've picked up bicycling as a thing that you do all the time.
I love it.
And you gave up banking, right? Like you're
hell's kind of, yeah.
That's right.
I gave up banking. I gave up banking like a mother.
That's right. Because they will suck you dry and steal your soul.
Oh.
And now you're giving up a cell phone. So yes. I feel like you and I could eventually like start a Hobbiton somewhere or something like that.
Yeah. I was thinking like this could go either really, really good, which I hope, or it could like really spiral out of control and then, you know, I'm that guy on the street just you know, I don't know, like the crazy guy on the street
muttering to yourself.
Yeah, muttering to myself and right. talking about how like the government and the banks and the cell phone companies are stealing my soul.
Right. And even if that's true, you want to do it like in an educated way so that right. you don't end up without stuff, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, everybody needs a roof over there.
Exactly. Well, here's to hoping. I'm raising my cup to that.
Holla, I raise the Pyrex.
There we go. Cup for that. Yeah. Last thing, Brandon Rhodes, former godlike co-host Brandon Rhodes,
amen.
And I were transporting lumber today. We hooked up the bike trailer.
Yeah. The big flatbed.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah. I think we may have actually stripped out the threads in the frame of Brandon's old bike. But we got the trailer attached.
The red Kona 2,
yeah.
Okay.
Which is the one he bought in Eugene, I think, when he was in college down there.
Aww.
And it's got a lot of memories.
Yeah.
But we've had this hitch hooked up to it for this huge super trailer that we've got, 4x8 with two mountain bike tires mm-hmm. holding it up. And we transported some lumber. It took us a long time to figure out how to get it on there, though, because there are no wheel wells on the trailer. That's the problem. We don't have any way to keep the stuff being carried, especially sheets of plywood that are also 4x8
oh, yeah.
from touching the wheels. So the smart thing to do would be to actually construct wheel wells, which I think will be my next kind of rainy day. It won't be a rainy day project. I'll do that when the weather is nice enough to be outdoors.
Yeah.
But we got it tied on eventually. We bought some extra scrap wood from the place. It wasn't scrap. It was just cheap wood, you know, odds and ends in a little barrel. And I think for 90 cents, we picked up one more piece. We had them cut it several times. And we arranged the whole load so that it would sit on the trailer in the best way possible.
Okay.
We only destroyed one bungee cord.
Hey.
It kind of came unsnapped from the load and wrapped itself around the axle. I had to cut it off with my pocket knife.
Oh.
My Leatherman, actually, which I purchased in Montana. But, yeah, we finished. We figured that out, finished off the cable, and we made it home, more or less. We were really worried because, I mean, there have been some bad things that happened with that trailer when I was piloting.
Wasn't there a time where you were coming up Woodstock and the trailer came out?
Like, there was. I think I may have told that story in an earlier episode.
You had.
Yeah. So just dumped a bunch of shit all over the road.
Yeah.
And then, without time to properly clean it up, I just left it there. I felt bad. I tried to clean it up as best I could. I left it.
You got it off the road, I recall correctly.
I left it in a heap on the sidewalk. And when I came back that night, either Craigslist people had come to my rescue or the people who owned the house said, this is an eyesore. Either way, I feel really bad for the people who live on, 53rd and Duke Street. But
hey,
anyways,
all's well then.
We all make mistakes.
That's
so.
Right.
So that was pretty fun. Well, hey, we've got an interview with Tracy Gayton from the Piscataquis Village Project. I'm trying really hard to remember how to pronounce it.
I do believe you said Piscataquis. Yeah. Yes.
Well, here.
Out in the middle of nowhere, Maine.
Yeah. Before we roll that, Tracy sent me a little thing, just in case there was any wonder about how to say the county names in Maine. He found this on YouTube.
This is great. Oh, no, you don't need to sing it again. I got it the first time.
So anyways, that's how you know. It's an easy mnemonic device.
Did they say Saginaw?
I believe so.
Huh. I'm going to have to look up the roots of that.
Yeah.
Because now that everybody knows I'm from Michigan.
That's right.
It's a major city over there.
Well, let's let this music play us into the interview with Tracy Gayton, and we'll be back after that.
Now you know the 16 counties.
looks like every broadcast video is live. I would assume at this point it's safe to say that we're probably being recorded and we can use this for later. This would be the Sprocket Podcast on Google Plus for the very first time. I am speaking with Tracy Gayton from the Piscataquis Village Project. Is that the appropriate pronunciation?
It's pretty close. Piscataquis.
Piscataquis. Okay, great. We called it Piscataquis the other day, and that's woefully wrong. So my apologies, but we are excited about the concept. So maybe first you could tell us just a basic summary of what the project is and then introduce yourself.
Okay. Well, we think this, what we're trying to create here is what we're calling a traditionally patterned village. And we think it would be the only one that's in the United States. Our concept is to acquire about 500 acres. And on this 500 acres, we want to take 125 acres of it and get regulatory approval to write our own set of building covenants that would guide the development of the site into a traditionally patterned village, the kind of villages that were common around the world until a couple of hundred years ago. The streets are narrow. It's scattered with small plazas. All the buildings are connected. And they front directly on the sidewalk. And also the buildings shelter the sidewalk, so you can walk and stay relatively dry and out of the climate. It's a typical kind of village pattern you see in old villages in Europe or Asia or even Latin America. But for I guess a number of reasons, they just flat out don't exist in the United States at all.
Yeah, and unfortunate ones at that. But yeah, and this is piscataquisvillage.org, is that correct?
Yes.
All right, so people can look it up, and we'll post a link to that as well. So why don't you introduce yourself and tell us how you got into this whole thing?
My name is Tracy Gayton, and I've lived in Piscataquis County, Maine, which is in central Maine, and since the early 1980s. And this isn't really my field at all. For most of my life, I was just the local branch manager in the town of Dover Foxcroft, which only has a population of about 4,000 people, which is the county seat in Piscataquis County. And I retired from the bank about 7 years ago. I did some traveling, some time in Europe and in South America. And I guess that's what really whetted my appetite for these very walkable, very traditional, very convenient types of cities that just don't exist anywhere in the United States. It's a little bit of a shock when you think about it. Of all the real estate subdivisions that have happened in the United States since World War II and even back before that, in all sorts of variations and forms, no one that we can find has deemed it, I guess, profitable or appropriate to design one of these types of walkable, pedestrian, car-free villages.
Yeah, you would probably assume that something like this would have been done. And I assume early U.S. cities, especially on the eastern seaboard, as people were just settling the continent, probably had earmarks of the European-style village. But by and large, with the introduction of the automobile and all of that, we really don't have any of those classic earmarks of an old-school village anymore, right?
True. And actually, you know, it even goes back before the automobile, interestingly enough. You know, if you look even at villages and cities that were built in the mid-1800s, you know, well before the automobile, even then the streets were becoming straight, becoming wider than you would need for pedestrians, stretched out. A lot of the buildings in the downtowns were still connected up, like we still have today in a lot of the downtown centers. But even 50 or 100 years before the automobile, the streets were starting to widen out. And different people have proposed different reasons for this. Some think of it as it may be a fire break. You know, some think of it as just our aesthetic that we had developed, you know, in the 1800s that kind of called for more rational, broader design, you know. So it's not even just the car factor. That certainly exacerbated it. It even started before that. We sort of got away from that traditional design. You really, as you said, you've got to go back to old-time Philadelphia or Boston, almost the colonial era in the United States to get what we're talking about.
Yeah, I was in Boston just a couple of days ago visiting in-laws for the Christmas holiday, and it's striking, the downtown core and the hub, as they call it in Boston, compared to your typical American city. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, as far as your own personal interest. You grew up, you said, I believe, either on your website or in your TEDx talk, you grew up in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, until I was in about sixth grade, I was in rural Pennsylvania. And then I moved with the parents to mostly suburban Florida until I was around 23 or 24 years old, and then I moved to Maine. I'm going to say I was probably, if you look back at it and try to analyze it psychologically, I was probably traumatized by suburban sprawl when I was, you know, in like fifth grade. You know, we left rural Pennsylvania and moved to Florida. And I would still come back summers to visit. But over the years, I would see my favorite woods that I used to play in as a kid, you know, subdivided into house lots. And it really, really traumatized me. Enough where you could say 30 years from now, I'm still trying to, you know, try to find a way in which we can maybe reduce this suburban sprawl by, you know, suggesting patterns of development where we dwell in more compact, you know, villages.
Yeah, the funny thing about the suburban idea altogether is that, like, it's very attractive on a micro scale. Just looking at one property, you say, like, oh, we have some land, a little bit of space, you know, enough for a trampoline or something. You got a large palatial house, and it's very attractive in that way. But when you look at it from the larger perspective, you don't have streets that lead to anything. There's a lot of wasted space, I think. And like you're saying, it kind of paves over those places that you used to play in when you were a kid. Right. So there's a lot of ways in which, look, taking it from the grand perspective, it can be kind of distasteful.
As soon as you leave that front lawn, it all goes to hell.
Right, exactly. and really, that's the case. I mean, as far as one of my big complaints, I used to live in Vancouver, Washington. Some of the only ways to get from some person's house to the store were through these enormous concrete canyons, basically created by walls and roads, and dominated by automobiles. And there's no sense of community that can be fostered. So you have a vision for a town that's really exactly the opposite of that.
Right, right. And, you know, there are certain downsides to totally rural areas too, in a way. I mean, I like to think this is a perfect combination of both town and country. Because on the upside, when I left rural Pennsylvania, I distinctly remember being totally blown away by the fact that I personally, on my own power, could walk somewhere and buy a candy bar. I mean, we lived so far out, you know, in the woods, you know, that if you wanted anything, you needed your mother to drive you somewhere. So it was a very empowering feeling to be able to walk or ride a bike to, if you had a few spare coins in your pocket, to go get a candy bar. So that was great, too, on the other side of it. So that's why I think it's kind of the best of both worlds. You know, the idea of living in a compact village, and this is compact enough. This would have a diameter of maybe only about 900 yards.
Right.
And, you know, 125 acres, if it's roughly circular, it works out to less than 900 yards in diameter. And then you're back out in a green zone where there's small scale agriculture, some parks, and you're in the Maine wilderness, you know, and so it's the best of both worlds. You've got a little bit of culture. You can walk to get your candy bar, and then you walk 5 minutes in the other direction, and you're out in the woods.
There you go. So it really is kind of, it's a good blending of both of those things.
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as the size is concerned, I'm not that great with just with distances in my head with numbers. So compared to something else, your idea for what this village would look like size wise, what does that compare to?
Well, you know, 900 yards is, it's hard to get around the football field comparison, but I'll tell you, it's 9 football fields, I guess you could say, in diameter roughly. It's about a 10-minute walk. It's about a 10-minute walk. You know, if you're to walk from one end to the other, the maximum walk you'd have would be about 10 minutes.
Right. Okay. And, yeah.
And which means if you're right in the center of the place, you would have a 5-minute walk to the edge, and we would have all the parking. Unfortunately, at this point in time, anyway, it's hard to get around cars and parking, at least, you know, to get from the village to other places.
Yeah.
So we would have all the parking on the perimeter, which would be a maximum distance of about a 5-minute walk from the very center.
Okay. Yeah. And that does create the effect of basically saying that when you're in the village, you're going to be getting around either on foot or do bicycles have a place in this town?
Well, you know, it's funny you should ask that. I was thinking about that today, knowing you're such a bicycle guy. And we do have a lot of bicyclists definitely interested in the project. And in some ways, it would be a great place to bicycle. I mean, the streets would have very few motor vehicles. You know, it's for emergency vehicles and probably for certain types of heavier freight delivery. It's about the only motorized vehicle you'd have on the roads. And so it would be, you know, a great place to bicycle. And But honestly, you know, if we're talking about a place that's only about a maximum distance of 10 minutes from one end to the other walking, you kind of have to question whether it's even worth it getting on a bike for most trips. You know,
right, yeah.
You're going to say, you're going to save a couple of minutes by hauling the bicycle out, maybe locking it up, unlocking it. You wonder if that's going to be as common a mode of transportation as a lot of people think.
Definitely. And I was thinking if you're either a bicyclist who's interested in speed and wearing tight clothing and moving quickly, then obviously the village doesn't lend itself to that because you've got apple carts metaphorically or possibly literally to upset. And then you've also got if you're someone who just likes to race around in a fixed gear in tight jeans, there are some similar problems with obstacles and basically being polite to people on the street. So So it's a different mode. Nothing about Piscataquis Village is probably about speed, I assume.
No, well, not really. No, although you could not actually speed, but as far as time goes, when I first moved to Maine, I lived a good 25 minutes from my job, you know, when I commuted by vehicle. And when I moved even to the town of Dover Foxcroft, I at least cut that down to 5 minutes, even though I was walking. So I think the average commute, looking at statistics in Piscataquis County, is something like 25 minutes as an average commute by car. You know, if you can cut that down to a maximum 10-minute commute inside the village, well, you've certainly saved a little bit of time there.
Definitely, and then you cut out the need for the car as well, so at least for getting around town.
Right.
What do you envision? This is obviously a place for people to live, and it seems like you're also looking at integrating business and some industry into the whole thing. What does a day in the life of the village look like?
Well, ultimately, we hope to have all of that. I think it's important to stress that the village project itself doesn't intend on building any buildings at all ourselves. We're more about creating fertile ground for the place. We're more about acquiring the land, writing the building covenants that guide the build out of the property. You know, we'd have to provide infrastructure, you know, water, wastewater treatment of some fashion. But beyond that, you know, people or developers build their own residences or commercial property pretty much the way they want it, as long as it's in accordance with our building code. And which means that certainly businesses are welcome. Any sort of retail, any sort of industry is welcome, you know, as long as it conforms to our building code. Doesn't make too much noise. Doesn't pour out much in the way of noxious fumes. You know, anything is welcome. It's kind of whatever goes. You know, whatever the people that live there will make of it what they can, and they're invited to.
Right. Yeah. And that's it seems to me like you've got basically it's sustainable in the best way possible, not only sustainable in the sense that you're encouraging, you know, a lower impact living on the earth. But it's also sustainable because like if it does work, it's going to have to be businesses and people who can stay there. So I suppose that's both the charm and some of the struggle in bringing it to reality.
It's true. You know, I'm sure that the first inhabitants that move into the place, you know, it is going to be mostly a residential type of place. It's going to probably be people that are retired, people that already have jobs in other towns in the vicinity. It's going to be perhaps part-time residents, and it's going to be that growing number of people that can actually earn an income no matter where they are. And I expect those will be the first pioneers, mostly to the village.
Yeah.
But those people have to be serviced in time by other businesses, and so you're going to have your restaurants and your coffee shops that hopefully will grow from there as they service the other people that are living there. And you know, one thing about this, you know, in traditionally patterned villages, one of the most common setups is to have is to be living over your own retail or commercial enterprise. You know, and it's the cheapest, about the cheapest way imaginable to get a business started. You know, it's space that you already own anyway. You know, I mean, I use myself as an example. I mean, my town of Dover Foxcroft, the village has got 2,500 people in it, and we haven't got a coffee shop. And I sometimes think, geez, you know, it would be great should I open a coffee shop in town, you know? But the answer is no, you know, because it would mean I would have to, like, rent some sort of space downtown, you know, make sure I had enough business to justify the rental, you know. But let me ask you this. If I owned a townhouse or a row house in the village, and all I had to do was put a coffee pot on downstairs in my own dwelling and put a few tables and chairs out, would I do that? And the answer is I would, you know, because all I have to do is clear, you know, sell 20 cups of coffee or something a day while I'm reading the paper like I would normally anyway.
Right.
And so because inherently in the design that we're proposing, it just makes it easier for many people to start businesses that they wouldn't even do normally.
Yeah, that's a personal dream of mine, actually, has been to, at some point, not necessarily to live over my own business, but certainly to live over a business, either a coffee shop or a bar or something where I could just pop downstairs and get something to eat or drink. I love the concept of that. And if you pair that with, you know, with business ownership and you're saying, hey, if you've always had a dream of owning a coffee shop, why not start your own? Because it's a low impact way to do it if you're already living there. So that's kind of cool. Do you want to talk about the age dynamic in Piscataquis? Piscataquis County, because that's a big factor in some of the siting, right?
Well, you know, I guess the biggest factor of siting in Piscataquis County is the fact that I'm from Piscataquis County.
And, right, so you like it already.
I like it already. I know the people. I know other people, friends of mine, that are interested in this project. You can look at Piscataquis County in a couple ways. We're the second largest county east of the Mississippi. And if we were a state, it would be something like the 47th biggest state. We only have 17,000 people, and that works out to we're the most sparsely populated county east of the Mississippi. So we're the size of some states with only 17,000 people. And Maine has just stolen the crown for being the most aged state in the nation. And Piscataquis County is about a third of the counties in Maine, you know, so it's an old population. And to put it bluntly, we're in the grip of a demographic winter where we've
right.
got more people dying than are being born and more people actually leaving the county that are coming into the county. And our population peaked in 1920 or so with 20,000 people. We're down about 3,000 people in the last 80 years or so.
And that's a fascinating dynamic. I mean, that's just like it's hard to imagine for me an area losing its population in that like at that rate of speed. It's something else.
And it's projected to lose more. I don't have the statistics right in front of me, but I think it's supposed to drop another 1,500 or so people over the next 15 years or so. And that's a pretty big percentage when we're only talking 17,000 people to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that do to our local institutions? I mean, we've got, for example, a new performing arts theater in town that a lot of people work pretty hard to put in place. What happens when you've got 1,500 people less in the county to support institutions like that? You know, do you reach some sort of tipping point where a few things start to close and then becomes less interesting to the people that do live there and they move away and it starts to devolve into something even worse, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, that's an interesting dynamic, you know, and a lot of the people that are have made an investment pledge to this project see this as a way of perhaps reversing that demographic trend. You know, if we can come up with something that is unique in the United States, you know, something that only occupies 125 acres, say the size of a small golf course, you know, mm-hmm. so it doesn't impinge on the rural character of the county, which is important to so many people. If we can attract people and still maintain the rural character of the place, that seems like, you know, a plus all the way around.
Yeah, and this is something that it's largely an attractional model because I assume most of the folks that already live in the county kind of have their living situation figured out. They're probably not looking to relocate and may not share the values of a village model like you do.
Well, yes and no. It's certainly a rural county and proud of it. You know, people live there because it's a rural county. Mm. But on the other hand, I think probably almost half of the people in the county do live in the villages, you know, not as a compacted village as we're proposing, but still close enough to be on public water and public sewer, you know, so they're not all living out in cabins in the woods, you know, so there is a dynamic of people who like the small town New England, you know, sort of life, which is
right.
kind of attractive, you know. So even though those towns are nowhere near as dense as what we're proposing or as compact as what we're proposing, there's still a segment that likes that. You know, what I think most people honestly like is, not all, but most people honestly like the attractions of being right in the village, you know, where they are close to everything, yet within a couple of minutes, 5 minutes, they can be out in the woods. I think that's what most people do like in Piscataquis County, that combination. Easy access to the woods, but also, you know, at least some cultural amenities, you know,
okay.
jobs, movie theaters, things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. It reminds me a lot, actually, just the population thing reminds me a little bit of going through small towns in just in the West in America, on my bicycle tours. For instance, last summer I went through Wyoming, and there's several towns out there that are losing their population and slowly becoming smaller. And I think this is a very creative solution. It's a really nice inventive way to keep a place that you love, to keep it vital and to keep it vibrant. So what has inspired you? I'm curious, just you mentioned you did some traveling. Where have you been as far as Europe or South America, places that you kind of wish that you live perhaps, or things that at least that give you fuel for the fire for this?
I guess the most the one single most inspiring place was I was fortunate enough to spend a month right in the city of Venice, which is I think an area is probably the largest car-free place in the world. You know, everybody thinks of it as the place with boats, but they should also think of it as a place without cars, because that's the situation. You know, there's no place to drive in Venice. There's one parking lot on the very edge of it. And so I visited an entire month in Venice and without seeing a car. I mean, if you think about that for a minute, how many people do you know that have gone a month without seeing a car, you know, in real life? It's a pretty amazing thing when you think about it.
Yeah, it's intense.
And it's a wonderful thing. I mean, you were within a few minutes walk to just about everywhere you wanted to go. It's got a permanent population of about 60,000 people. You know, you saw elderly people making the way around on foot perfectly fine. You know, it's got 12 million tourists a year that are attracted to Venice. You know, it's one of the most heavily touristed places in the world. But the idea that you can have a perfectly modern, perfectly civilized city of 60,000 permanent residents without a single vehicle is it's pretty amazing. And it's, you know, at night when things quiet down a bit, all you hear are the footsteps of people's feet on the streets, and it's a marvelous thing.
Yeah, it seems so ideal, and that's actually something. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say I was there in the winter, so I can't say. I've heard stories about what it might that some of the water might be a little polluted in the summer months, but I was there in the winter, and it was a great time to be there.
Yeah, I had never thought about the sound dynamic. I mean, that's obviously a big piece of our lives, and a lot of us have learned to tune out the noise of highways or freeways that are near our house. For example, I have a freeway like 5 blocks from my house, and it's a constant drone, but I don't hear it anymore because, you know, I've been here long enough to kind of forget about it. But to be in a place where the dominant noise is footfalls, that's an intriguing concept.
It is. It's interesting that when I was in Dover Foxcroft this summer, you know, I was on kind of the main drag through town, this town of 2,500 people, and it was much noisier there than it was in the heart of Venice with 60,000 residents and 12 million visitors. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm curious, there's another project that has been on my radar for a little while called Bicycle City USA. And I honestly don't know where they are right now. Last time I went to their website, I think it was shortly after I learned of yours, just kind of to compare. Do you have any knowledge of them or any ideas?
The last I knew about, it's been a while since I'm familiar with them in South Carolina. The last time I looked at their site, it seemed like something was on hold.
Right.
I'm not sure, and I'm not sure where they are either. I thought perhaps they'd run across a few regulatory issues. I thought I'd heard that as far as getting certain approvals done. But, you know, I can't say for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just thinking perhaps the downfall of the great idea is kind of the bicycle branding, just because this is a model that a lot of people probably would appreciate. But if you limit it, at least in the way that you talk about it to people who are into bicycles, you may not find enough people to make that vision come to light. So I don't know. I haven't talked to them, and I do wish them the best, but I could see that being an issue. And maybe a strength on your project is just that it's not specifically one kind of person that you're trying to attract. It's a multiple, it's a lot of people that probably have very similar values. So
true. I mean, If you ask me, if you're trying to come up with a project that doesn't appeal to a broad segment of society, it's really questionable as a solution. You know, if you're really only attracted to a small particular type of person, it's like I like to say, a lot of people I think do recognize the conviviality aspect of this place. I mean, when you've got narrow streets, where you brush elbows with people every day when you walk down the street, and you've got small plazas where you can meet and greet people every day, as opposed to just at best giving them a wave as you drive by in your automobile. It's a very convivial place, and people pick up on that, and it's one of the attractions for a lot of people. This has the potential of being a friendly, social kind of place. But, you know, I like to stress, you know, just to play the devil's advocate a little bit, you know, misanthropes are welcome, too. You know, unless you can appeal to the misanthropes, you know, in addition to the social people, then, you know, you really haven't got a valid, pervasive solution to anything, you know, because it takes all kinds.
It's true. So how does one appeal to a misanthrope?
I guess we tell them where we've got connected buildings, there's no windows on the sides of their houses, so they don't have to look at the neighbors on the sides. You know,
there we go, that's a big improvement over a lot of suburban developments, actually. Yeah.
Well, that's right. You know, I've often said, if you're going to have 20 feet separating you from another house, you know, you're better off not connecting the houses, because that 20 feet is just wasted space, you know?
Definitely. So do you see any possibility of transit linkage? Like, do you envision, if you can get this project going, that someday there might be a bus that runs to a train terminal, to the airport, something like that? Or do you think, obviously, it'll probably start with private car ownership, just for transport to and from the village?
I do envision that. It's an open question on what kind of critical mass of population you need there to before that gets initiated, you know. But once again, kind of like the point I sort of made of how the form is intrinsically friendly to starting small businesses, I think it's also intrinsically friendly to transit in some way, because you've got a very compact, you know, set of people right there. So there's not a question of if you had, say, any kind of private entrepreneur who wants to start a van service from the village to some of the other neighboring larger towns. I mean, those small people are going to be in probably initially a 5-acre area. So, I mean, it's very easy just to pull your van up and pick those people up and make an hourly or every 2-hour run to some of the other villages. I can see that happening fairly soon in the process. We're raising capital for this project by trying to get 200 people to pledge $10,000 to the project as a minimum. So if we do achieve that goal, we've already started with a pool of about 200 people. You know, not all of them will be in a position to move there. Not all of them are even want to move there. Some see it as simply a positive project that they want to, you know, support. But even if you got 100 people, you know, half of your 200 original investors, you know, that's 100 households that are there, you know, living in an area that might be probably within a 5-acre area. And there are probably people that do have a bias in favor of, riding a van to the nearest town as opposed to taking their private car. So I guess I'm confident that fairly early in the process, we would at least be have some semblance of, transit service. You know, yeah. As you say, starting with small vans or taxis, we already do have a very limited, somewhat limited service by one of the CAP agencies, Community Action Programs, where you can call the van and they will pick you up and take you to some of the towns around. So I'm sure we could integrate into that as probably the very first step.
Very nice. Yeah, and that's actually not a bad way to go. There's a community action project that I have used to connect Tacoma to Portland several times, just trying to see if I can get there by bus. So it can be done with enough elbow grease, enough time.
It's a challenge sometimes, yeah. That's for sure.
Well, I'm curious about, you mentioned there's some neighborhood covenants that would be between the residents who live there, I assume. Is there also red tape on the governmental side?
I'm sure there will be. This is one of, and I think, I'm hoping anyway, that this might be one of the other advantages of Piscataquis County. All of the towns in Piscataquis County, like many towns in New England, they have a very, probably the most democratic form of municipal government that exists, you know, the New England town meeting, where, you know, if you can, anyone can place a proposal before the town, and in their annual town meeting, the town votes on it. You know, we would have certain, you know, other hurdles that are dictated by the state of Maine, for example, and maybe even some federal hurdles. But at least it's intimate. It's an intimate enough area where you can, you know, directly go to the people in whatever town that we might end up in and, you know, present our proposal. And almost by talking to people over the kitchen table, you know, try to convince them of the virtue of our idea. and you know, get them to vote in favor of it in an open town government sort of forum. And I think that's one of the advantages of Piscataquis County, Maine, that's often overlooked, you know. So many projects have just, you know, ended up on the rocks, you know, due to government red tape and bureaucracy, mm-hmm. you know, even in the state of Maine, certainly some of them also, you know, projects that are not anywhere near even as radical as what we're proposing in some ways.
Yeah. What's the weather like up there?
Right now? It can get pretty cold in the winter. But speaking personally, you know, the thing I disliked most about Maine weather is having a drive in it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that dread of knowing there's a storm coming and you're going to have to maybe dig your car out if you haven't got a garage. Or you've got to worry about, you know, ice storms and snowstorms, and or maybe leaving that party early because it's snowing, you've got to get home, you know, or not going to a party and participating in social activities because of the weather. You know, if you can eliminate the hassle of driving in some of the bad weather, I mean, to me, that's a big step forward.
Sure.
That's huge. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, have to drive in an ice storm, and it's another when you just have to put on a heavy coat and walk on a sheltered sidewalk, you know, a dry sheltered sidewalk to wherever you want to go in 5 minutes, you know.
Yeah. Did we talk about the arcading? Is that that's a big concept for you as well, is the idea that a lot of sidewalks could be sheltered by existing buildings?
It is, and it's a damn difficult thing to verbalize. You know, you really need pictures to explain that. You know, we've got we have what we call six key elements of design, which are the basis for our project, and that is small squares are connected up by narrow streets, buildings front directly on the sidewalk, they connect with other buildings at the sides, but the second floor also juts out over the sidewalk to shelter it. And the blocks are arranged in a way so that there's a little bit of common space in the middle of the village blocks, and the cars are parked on the outside. So those are basically our six design elements. It's you know, small plazas, narrow streets, connected buildings, arcaded covered sidewalks, you know, interior courtyards in the blocks, and it's car free. But different people come to the project with I guess you could say favorite key design elements. One of our investors in the project is a guy named J.H. Crawford, who's written a couple of notable books. One's called Car-Free Cities, and the other's called The Car-Free Design Manual. And I'm very pleased to have him in as one of our investors in this project, internationally known guy. And he visited Piscataquis County for a few weeks this summer. And, you know, he comes from it mostly from the standpoint of, you know, predictably, you know, it's a car-free city. There's another guy, Phil Lacombe, who has a blog called Small Streets, and to him it's great because it's a narrow street village. You know, I think I've got to say my favorite design element, if you want to get into that, are those arcaded covered sidewalks.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, I've often thought if you're going to have buildings that connect up anyway, it's just such a small step to just require that to let that second floor come out and shelter those sidewalks.
And then you don't have to shovel the walk afterwards. Like, you don't have to deal with all the piled up snow and
exactly.
all that.
Exactly. And it gets back to the weather thing. You know, as I say, the worst part is trying to jump over those slush puddles and crawl over snow banks. But, you know, you're permanently protected when you walk under those, mostly protected when you walk under those sheltered sidewalks.
Yeah, that's a great design element. And I could get fully behind that.
Well, it's kind of stolen, I guess, mostly from the city of Bologna, Italy. This is kind of an interesting story, really. I guess back, Bologna has one of the first universities in Western civilization. And they had a major influx of students into Bologna, so the story goes. And the founding fathers of the city, their idea with student housing was to actually encourage the building owners to build out their second floor over the sidewalk. Not so the students could live in the extra space, but so the students could sleep on the sidewalk, protected from the elements. So
there we go.
And so now you can walk through miles of downtown Bologna under these covered sidewalks. And you look, you arrive there and you look around after a few minutes and you think, every city should be designed this way. It's just a no-brainer.
Definitely. I don't suppose it's probably still legal to sleep on the sidewalk now as it exists, in the present day at least, but I like the idea.
Me too. I think some people might get away with it, though.
Yeah. I was actually this last summer on a bicycle tour going through Walla Walla, Washington, and we were avoiding a storm, and so we ended up hiding out under this covered walkway behind a church, and it was probably kind of like that. I imagine the experience of being a university student and sleeping on the sidewalk in Bologna is probably very similar, except we were scared because we thought we'd be discovered, so that's not as good.
Right.
Well, is there anything else before we close out, anything else you'd like to promote? Obviously, we'd like the web address and how we can get involved if anybody's interested.
Yeah, we've got a Facebook page and a website that you mentioned. It's Piscataquis. Believe it or not, is a rare enough word that if you know how to spell it, you can put it in almost any search engine and find us pretty easily. Knowing how to spell it is the trick. But we do have a Facebook page and a website. As I said, we're trying to raise investment capital for the project. That's our primary goal right now. I mean, not too much happens until we get that done, you know. And we've reached a little more than one-fifth of our goal. We're trying to raise, we think, $2 million as a goal, and we're at $410,000 right now. So we're getting there. We think that the more pledges that we get, that the easier it will become, and it will snowball a little bit, and we'll hit our $2 million.
Very good. And you also have the TEDx talk, which I just watched this morning, actually, in preparation for the interview. It's on YouTube under your name, Tracy Gayton.
Yep, you can find it that way, sure.
All right. Great.
I was petrified during that talk, but got through it okay.
It didn't show. It came out very well. It was a huge audience?
I think there's about 300 people there. We're doing pretty good on views. You know, I think over a couple thousand people have seen it now, and it's only been out just a little over a month, so we're making some progress there.
There we go. Yeah, that's enough people to make your knees knock, I'm sure.
Sure, and it was enough. Yeah, and it was. I'm very pleased that TEDx Dirigo, the state of Maine TEDx, invited us to to present, because it was a great honor, really.
Yeah, that's great. Well, let's see here. I was going to ask you about simplifying your own life. Is there anything that you've cut out of your life that made you happier for having done so in the past couple months, years?
I think, honestly, there are a few people that have simplified their life, honestly, quite as much as I have. When I retired about 7 years ago, I sold about everything I have, and everything I own fits in about three trunks that are in my mother's closet in Florida, and I've been traveling pretty much with a backpack for the last 7 years.
Oh, wow. So you're really living the dream then. That's what many of me and many of my listeners would love to be doing. Could we afford to do so? So that's congratulations.
It's the dream for some, not all. It's worked out great for me. It allows me to concentrate on this project. You know, I don't have anything else to think about it, and it allows me to work on this.
Yeah. Yeah, so you've got a great many things. I guess I didn't know the answer to that question when I asked it, but that's kind of it's almost here and there. It's two completely different existences since you retired. So
it is, and you know, assuming the village project works out, I will establish some sort of base in Piscataquis Village, but it will be, I can assure you, just a very small type of apartment. You know, certainly less than probably 300 square feet. Just have a base of operate, you know, just have a base, and that'll be it, I'm sure.
Very good. Well, thank you, Tracy, so much for taking the time. It really means a lot, and we wish you the very best of success with the project.
All right. Thank you very much.
And we'll be staying tuned for updates, I guess.
Okay, Brock. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Take care.
You bet.
That's right. That was Tracy Gayton, PiscataquisVillageProject.org. You were saying that's some of the worst coffee you have ever had?
This is, yes. I can't think of, in my memory right now, a worse cup of coffee. This beats out some gas station coffees.
Oh, I am sorry for the experience. I hope it is quickly remedied by some other experience that you enjoy more.
Yeah.
Oh, we got some mail. Should we go to that?
Let's do the mail.
All right.
Let's forget about this craptastic coffee.
Lay it on me.
All right, mail. Gus sends us this photo and says, no words necessary.
And,
however, you're going to have to put words to it, Brock, because I cannot see this.
Because this is an audio medium. That is the case. What we have here is a mountain bike. equipped with a ski in the place of a front wheel.
Yeah.
And a track attached to the back. There's a couple extra wheels to lengthen the track, and basically you have a snowmobile on a bike.
That is really awesome.
Yeah. So once you've seen the picture, no words necessary.
No words are necessary for this.
We'll put a link up to that.
Sweet. Johnny K asks us where to put a sticker on a bicycle and says that in Jacksonville, Florida, I'm assuming?
Yeah.
All right.
Yes, it is.
A fellow cyclist is like finding water in a desert. This makes the cycling traffic problems of Portland somewhat niche.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
I would say the Top Tube, in my opinion, is a great place for stickers on a bike just because, you know, it's the flattest spot you can find. It's curved, but if you get the right stickers, especially stickers without corners, such as ours, then you can do that.
Yeah. If you have a bucket, that's a great place for stickers.
Right. A bike bucket.
Yeah.
A bucket converted to hang on your rear rack as a pannier.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those things are great.
That's where I like to put my stickers. I'm kind of a purist, like, for putting stickers on my bike. I don't like doing that.
Right. Yeah. I only have one and it's my own. So
I guess I have reflective stickers, but that's different. That's
right.
A safety
right.
thing.
It's not like a logo or a, yeah.
Right.
Well, it's like some people are bumper sticker people. Some people are not.
Yeah. Well, I like stickers on my bucket anyways.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But I like to, despite the fact that like my frame is trashed and all marred up far as the paint job and whatever, I still don't like to put stickers on it.
Well, some people are bumper sticker people, and some people put bumper stickers all over their vehicle.
That's true.
And there is a difference.
Good point.
Yeah. Actually, Dan Christensen from Roll Easy Blog, one of our upcoming guests next week.
That's right.
He found a picture of a car just covered in stickers.
Really?
And he had some funny thing that he said about it that I can't remember right now.
We got to get him to send that to us.
We'll
post it with him. Lastly, Darren says, thanks for the song, Brock. Thanks for the song. Brock wrote about his cycling journeys.
So I'm putting this all in like the third person or something.
Yeah.
My apologies.
Quote.
That's my copy. It's my fault. I'll take responsibility.
It's cool. I need to read ahead. That's all. Quote, I've been meaning to update my blog, write a closing post, and list the highs and lows of the journey. But
this
more importantly,
the worldwide journey that he took and blogged about last year. And the song is
which
a song
we have linked to. Yes, no.
We will. Okay. We will on this. Yeah, right here.
Right? Oh yeah, there's. The
click on Darren's name. You'll find
underline.
His blog.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is. He made a donation to our fundraising campaign this last fall, and one of the rewards that I offered was writing a song about you. So Darren's song is done. Finally.
Yeah.
And
it's pretty badass.
Oh, thank you. Although, as you stated,
I'm not a pop guy.
Yeah, which is fine. It's okay not to like pop music.
I'm not lying either. It's pretty badass.
Oh, well, thank you. That's nice of you to say. I put some work into it, and then I actually got kind of scared of writing songs, and I was like, oh, shit, what have I signed myself up for? And that's why it took so long for me to get to the final product, because I was just kind of scared of what was going to happen. I wasn't sure how it was going to work out. But, you know, it came out with something that he was happy with and I was happy with. So, yeah.
Yay.
And...
Oh, yeah.
So
more
he's
importantly, he wants to share what... Well, now I'm trying to quote here, but then paraphrase while quoting. This is terrible. Sharing what I learned whilst on the road. I think the song has just inspired me to do so.
Excellent.
So, hey, yeah.
Well, anyways,
energy all around.
Thank you, Darren, for the donation. Thank you for your inspiring material. Thanks for going out and writing and traveling and doing all that.
Heck yeah.
And that is episode 64, something like that. Anyways, if you go to thesprocketpodcast.com and search for Darren Sinn,
you will find
S-I-N-N, you'll find him, yeah, and our interview with him. That was last June or July that we posted that. I think I posted it on the 4th of July because I wanted to have a non-American. He's from Australia.
Right.
I wanted to have a non-American on for the 4th of July. Just, you know, because I'm roguish. So
you don't have episode 64 on my list here.
Oh, really?
I was going to correct you. I was going to correct you with these notes. Well, actually, that's episode 60, whatever. Yeah. But I don't see them on here.
So we'll play that song after we get done with our show.
Yeah.
Which is very soon. You want to read the upcoming shows and then we'll get out of here.
I would love to. Right, about
very soon.
Really. Now.
Okay.
Upcoming shows are on the 27th, like we mentioned, Dan Christensen from Roll Easy Blog. On the 3rd of February, Sky Boyer from Velo Cult. Those of you listening from Portland, you would do yourself justice by not just listening to that episode, but also going to Velo Cult and hanging out. And
it's a cool place.
Yeah, it's a great place. Experience it. On the 10th, Chris Smith from Portland Transport.
He's kind of like a god for Portland transportation.
Yeah.
People. We're nervous.
Yeah. You know, we've been getting a lot of good guests.
Yeah.
I've been catching myself being I've told you this 100 times, being starstruck.
Yeah. And
like, for example, with the Sky Boyer interview, I don't think I've said like more than, you know, 2 or 3 sentences.
Yeah, well, Sky, that guy, like coolness drips off of him, like, you know.
It kind of does.
Like he was a honeycomb and the coolness was honey or something.
I just want to put it on my bread.
Is that a weird way to say that?
With some butter.
Yeah.
And then toast it.
All right.
on the 17th, this I am totally looking forward to. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. Ellie Blue and Martina Farner on women and the cycling industry.
Yeah. So that'll be good. It was episode 84.
Oh, look at you.
So I knew that we had to find out what that was, and now we know.
It would bother me all day.
Well, you know how it goes. All right. You want to give us our closing credits, sir?
I would love to. Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program and suggestions for topics and or guests and or drinks. Something better than this creme brulee coffee. Write us via email. The address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Or call and leave us a message at 503-847-9774. Connect with us on Twitter at sprocketpodcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. Find him on the internet at ryanjlane.bandcamp.com. Thanks to Hurt Bird for our headline sounder. Find them at hurtbirdmusic.com.
Packed 1 year to roam, a single tread on quiet roads, shouldering a heavy load. Bushmills for a dram or two, strangers stop to say, how do you do? Many pints pass through my hands, so good to see you again. Thousand miles.